Here are the numbers now. Wind west at 5. Humidity is dropping. It's at 78%. 68 degrees Racine. 67 in Kenosha. 61 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's a great pleasure for me to be welcoming back into our studios once again the single most frequent guest to the morning show during my time here, Dr. Art Sear. I'm sure many of you see his columns on a regular basis that appear in newspapers all across the country, also author of After the Cold War, and a monthly visitor to the morning show to offer his thoughts on various issues and concerns, particularly of a global scale. And we have several important topics that we're going to be exploring over the next few minutes. Dr. Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. I show up because of your always gracious introductions.
Well, good. Glad.
Please keep going.
All right. There you go. I'm happy to put out the welcome mat.
No, I needed that. Thank you.
Enthusiastically as I could. So glad to be able to talk with you about several different things that you've written about as of late. One of them that it will be great to spend a little bit of time talking about is a column that you wrote about Russia and Ukraine and what is essentially kind of an unintended consequence. And of course, Mr. Putin is really good at generating unanticipated or inadvertent consequences to a lot of his actions because of being, in a sense, kind of such an aggressive leader of Russia. And in this particular case, his aggression towards Ukraine has inadvertently led to, in a sense, the strengthening of NATO. And so, first of all, let's start with kind of the heart of that particular matter. How has Russia's attack on Ukraine had a positive effect on NATO?
Well, the alliance has been re-energized. There's comprehensive unity, including the very direct and very tangible supply of substantial armaments, as well as other supplies and material, including foodstuffs, at least indirectly related to the NATO alliance. But NATO does engage in humanitarian relief in different parts of the world, beyond Europe. The alliance has expanded with Finland and Sweden joining. Germany, quite understandably and in a very positive way, since World War II, they have a very substantial military, especially their army, and very effective as usual. But Germany has also had a very strong anti-military as well as anti-nuclear sentiment, reinforced after the Cold War by the very benign leadership, long-term leadership of Angela Merkel. The new, much less colorful government led by Chancellor Scholz has really shown considerable courage, given their frontline role and given their history in providing direct aid to Ukraine. So the alliance has been re-energized, which I believe very much surprised Putin, because one could argue that appeasement was in the air during his earlier, much more limited military aggression against seizing Ukraine, against seizing Crimea, invading eastern Ukraine in 2014, and also invading parts of Georgia, where Russian army troops remain. I almost said Red Army. So he's certainly been surprised. I'm confident by the fact that NATO has been so strong and his own military has been so incredibly, almost unbelievably ineffective so far in Ukraine. It's very different from the way people, especially informed people, tended to look at the situation and anticipate events before the invasion.
Right. So you're saying Putin sort of imagined that there would be sort of a falling away, speaking of disarray, that those that stand in opposition to this action would be sort of falling back and cowering in fear, and that has not been the case. There's been a reinforcement of those who oppose what Putin has done.
Yeah, in many different ways,
right,
including but going well beyond the military dimension in a kind of geostrategic way. Finland and Sweden are people, including me, tend to think of Scandinavia in broad terms. Finland is historically, ethnically, in lots of ways different from Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Iceland. Thanks to geography, they've been a traditional foe of Russia and the Soviet Union. About the same time that Germany and the Soviet Union invaded Poland in 1939, the Red Army launched a very large-scale invasion of Finland, and the Finns, 39-40, fought them to a standstill. A lot of people, even well-informed people, think that the Finns were overrun. It was actually a negotiated settlement. And earlier history repeating, the Soviets were suffering very, very heavily from a much smaller military force. Sweden's history has been much different, a very self-conscious and kind of self-righteous neutral for a couple of hundred years after their own imperial era. During the Vietnam War, Sweden was, quite adamant about not joining NATO when their neighbor Norway did when the alliance was formed. A lot of countries understandably welcomed draft evaders during our very troubling Vietnam War. The Swedes were distinctive in welcoming deserters, a very different population. And for a while in the 70s, Sweden had a very, very high crime rate. Deserters, army deserters, were very different from young men who were resisting the draft and went to Canada and other
right.
places.
Conscientious objectors, yeah.
Exactly. Yes, but not just self-described conscientious objectors, but young men who wanted to avoid the war because they were very anti-war.
Right. Interesting.
Or just didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Right. One of the things you mentioned in this column about Sweden and Finland joining NATO is that this was something that the nation of Turkey opposed, or
yes.
at least for a time opposed. and it sounds like it's for kind of a complicated reason that the Turks, or at least their leader, had such a problem with that. Explain what the problem was.
The Kurdish minority is an ethnic challenge generally in the Middle East and Persian Gulf area and the Balkans. It's a population that goes across various national boundaries. And one particular Kurdish independence movement, which has been violent historically, is one that, again, members of Kurdish separatist groups, not one but at least two, maybe several, have found refuge in Scandinavia. And Erdogan wanted a formal declaration from the leaders of Finland and Sweden that, in fact, they would not provide shelter to any Kurdish separatists.
So it sounds like there was ultimately a resolution to that.
Yes.
Explain the process by which that issue was resolved, and in a sense, Turkey withdrew its opposition to these two newcomers to NATO.
The three government leaders actually signed a document, not a treaty, but it was the three heads of government getting together. It was partly President Erdogan flexing his muscles, which he likes to do, and reminding everyone that Turkey is a very powerful nation militarily. They are the second largest army by far in NATO. After the United States, he's someone who has been in power way too long, not just in my opinion, and has autocratic tendencies, to be sure, and he's been nothing short of disastrous for Turkey's economy, which was doing quite well before he arrived early in the century. At the same time, Turkey has, it's important because the media focuses on him and all the disruptions and difficulties. Turkey has been a very loyal member of the NATO alliance from the beginning. They had a very large military force in the Korean War, and the North Koreans would avoid the Turks because they have such a powerful, well-deserved reputation as warriors. Hmm. They had command responsibilities, military and civilian, during our long, unhappy, fitful war in Afghanistan. They have been, in military terms, very loyal to the NATO alliance. And my strong impression is the Turkish people tend to be very friendly to Americans and friendly to the United States, another country with a very complicated history.
Hmm. So you said that this agreement in which we add Sweden and Finland to NATO without losing Turkey.
Yes.
So adding these two important nations to the north without losing this important nation to the south, you call that a major strategic victory.
Yeah. Russia is now effectively ringed geographically. It's particularly important to keep Turkey involved for the reasons I've been trying to make clear, but also Putin and Erdogan have been very successful in many ways diplomatically in the Middle East, where the U.S. has not really been an effective leader for several decades, in my view. And they collaborate very effectively. Mm-hmm. They also have some conflicts, especially regarding Syria and the long, brutal civil war there. But insofar as Turkey's membership in NATO is reconfirmed, in effect, the potential for even more cooperation between Putin and Erdogan, and I believe Putin has very effectively replaced the United States as a principal actor in that region, even though we've had some diplomatic successes, including under President Trump.
I think it's very strategically very important, at least in my opinion. Mm.
So did we have a hand in this agreement that was hammered out between Turkey and Finland and Sweden, or is this, in a sense, something they did on their own?
Well, since we're so integrally involved in the NATO alliance, I'm sure at the working diplomatic level, American diplomats and other U.S. officials, including military, played very helpful roles. But like the best sort of diplomacy, that has not been featured in publicly, and I'm very glad about that.
Right.
But it's basically the three nations. Mm. It's their initiative and their success. Mm. And the case of Sweden, for the history, again, I tried to make clear that's important and pretty unhappy in terms of our dealings with them. Mm. That's a really significant move by Sweden. Mm.
One of the things you talk about in this column is that it is important that NATO add Finland and Sweden, not just because of the way in which they further, in a sense, ring Russia in geographically, but also their proximity to the Arctic and the fact that the Arctic region is of tremendous importance, and it's something that Russia seems to recognize more than we do.
Yes. Well, we're both... that's a very good point. There's something called the Arctic Council, which is nations, including the United States, that are geographically involved in the Arctic. We are, don't forget, Alaska, in very, you know, practical terms. Iceland handed over the chairmanship of this council to Russia in 2021, with Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Every member of the Arctic Council except for Russia is now a NATO member. Hmm. That's really important in the context of the fact that Vladimir Putin, who must have phenomenal energy, whatever his faults, he's a very, very effective, practical leader, as well as a dictator at home. He's had a number of international successes. Russia, in terms of mineral exploration, Russia, in terms of having major international conferences, including business people, men and women in organizations with heavy-duty finance capital, military people, academics, Russia has been a leader in this century in terms of communication, cooperation, collaboration regarding the Arctic. No American president in recent times has, there have been some symbolic gestures. Obama going to Alaska to make a major policy speech represents that. But after the Obama speech, that was it. Mm. We have not really followed up regarding the Arctic. For that reason, especially, I think it's really significant that these two countries are in NATO. The Arctic has a lot of resources. During the early phases of the Cold War, we were rightly preoccupied with the danger of a nuclear attack by Soviet bombers coming over the North Pole. NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command, now the Aerospace Command, was established in the 50s and 81. Their title changed, but close U.S.-Canadian cooperation continues for that reason. With the development of effective intercontinental ballistic missiles starting in the 1960s and submarine-launched missiles, bombers went into the background. But in terms of military vulnerability, the Arctic remains extremely important. Likewise, there are a number of territorial disputes, the melting of Arctic ice and the accessibility of Arctic regions generally to commerce, but also just human occupation, means the territorial disputes that have lingered, some of them for hundreds of years, have become much more important. And Russia is very, very aggressive in litigating these complicated matters in their interest.
Right.
It's a very important region. Eisenhower, to his credit, the first nuclear arms agreement, the Kennedy-Khrushchev test ban treaty of 1963, ending nuclear testing in the atmosphere, something we thankfully can take for granted today, but things were so crazy back then. We were actually exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, adding to cancer rates and pollution and everything else. That rightly is recognized and celebrated. People are generally unaware of the fact that in 1959, Ike was able to demilitarize the Arctic, the Antarctic, excuse me. He was able to get an agreement on demilitarization of Antarctica, which is still essentially respected. That, to me, at least indirectly, helps what should be a very aggressive American effort currently to exercise leadership. And the fact that Finland and Sweden have now joined Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Canada, others in the Arctic Council provides a real opportunity.
And now that they are part of NATO, that is a positive as far as we're concerned.
And I believe demonstrating military power in the Arctic in these tense times is what we should be doing. Speaking of nuclear weapons, nuclear power, and Eisenhower, in 1959, the Nautilus, the first nuclear-powered submarine, the same time that very effective leader was getting a demilitarization treaty regarding the South Pole, Eisenhower sent the Nautilus under the North Pole at a time when that was very hard to do. Without saying anything publicly, it was a way of showing the Soviets, this is what we can do. Pay attention to this. This is what we can do to you. At a time when public sentiment was very much the other way, that the Soviets are on the march, that we are being weakened constantly, that we've got to be more aggressive militarily. So that provides a kind of example for how I think our leader should be operating in our current very tense time. Putin had made a big deal about putting the Russian flag on the ocean floor under the North Pole a few years ago. Nobody pays attention to the Nautilus in Antarctica. It's one reason I bring it up on your program. Believe me, the Russians are very much mindful of this history, very much aware of it.
Yeah. And you're saying that when Eisenhower did that, made that decision with the Nautilus, that that is something he did quietly. I mean, without a lot of fanfare, but enough so that Russia would know about it. But there'd be several different ways to go about doing that, and one of them would be to give a big speech on national television.
Think of Ike as the anti-Trump. I do. And why he's been so durable, underappreciated, especially by professors at the time, but our great nation has just opened an enormously garish, enormously overdone 4-acre memorial to Eisenhower in D.C. within the last couple of years. Ike himself would have hated it, but it shows that, number one, we're monument happy, and number two, today, it's true.
Yeah, right.
And number two, we're finally appreciating just how significant he was.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. Art Sear, paying his monthly visit to the program. We're touching on a number of different issues. Let's go to a different part of the world, and let's talk about the small yet significant nation of Taiwan. And of course, Taiwan was very much in the headlines there for a while, thanks to a much discussed, highly controversial visit to Taiwan by U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi. First of all, explain why this was, in a sense, such a big deal and why it stirred up such controversy. Why was this as significant a matter of criticism as it was?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure there's a good answer, because the Taiwanese have emphasized the Congress quite shrewdly since we formally ended diplomatic relations with them and formally recognized the People's Republic in only during the Carter administration, after President Nixon opened the door in 72. The Taiwanese have focused on the Congress. And last spring, two U.S. senators visited Taiwan with no big fanfare. There's been at least one congressional delegation, a fairly sizable one, visiting Taiwan since Speaker Pelosi was there. One reason it is the Speaker of the House. She is very publicly critical of China and has been for many years. And all politicians love publicity, and other people do too, including some professors even. But she is particularly anxious to kind of poke him in the eye. Mm. Also, the visit was timed purely by coincidence. Speaker Pelosi was originally going to go earlier this year, but because of COVID, I believe she came down with it, among others.
Mm. Yeah.
The visit was rescheduled. I don't know if she planned this, but it was coincident with the big party Congress where President Xi Jinping celebrated himself even more than usual. And it provided a propaganda opportunity as well as a source of real tension and irritation for Beijing. So it became, partly because of her, partly because of coincidence, but especially because of the nature of the communist regime.
Right. So China lashed out, unhappy that she was going do that. And then there were plenty of people who thought, well, it's not a good idea for us to make China angry in this way.
There are some people who felt way. And it was a natural magnet for global media attention. And with the 24/7 news cycle, this turned into a major event.
Right. Your column is quite interesting about it, because you discuss the not simple relationship between mainland China and Taiwan.
Yes.
And I think, you know, once upon a time, there was nothing but just icy distance between the two. But that, in fact, you say at one point, nonetheless, you know, despite all the tensions, de facto economic cooperation built steadily, if slowly, over time continues. So there is actual cooperation. And at one point you said, it went so far as to say, Taiwan is an essential investor for the economic revolution on the mainland.
Yes.
So that really caught me by surprise. I mean, just when you think about how Taiwan is dwarfed by mainland China in square miles, if nothing else. But how is it that that Taiwan should matter so much to as immense a nation as China?
Taiwan literally is a source of financing, along with South Korea and other nations in Asia, the phenomenal free market success and political success as a democracy of Taiwan is just tremendous, astounding in historic terms, and very much to the direct benefit of the United States, and a reflection of our very effective foreign policy over the time, over years. What doesn't make news very much is that overseas Chinese, that diaspora has done extraordinarily well, generally in Asia, but more broadly internationally, in all kinds of ways, including commercially. Overseas Chinese are a tremendous source, along with much more visible financial institutions, of investment in the mainland. Overseas Chinese can vote in Taiwan elections. And the Taiwan government very shrewdly has set itself up as a funnel for this money into the mainland. The column, because they're important, and thank you for mentioning it, there have been a whole series under the headlines, beyond the news, whole series of practical agreements between Taiwan and the mainland over the last several decades, including ECFA, the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement, which has facilitated practical commerce. There's always been a big black market, but legal trade has been greatly facilitated by these practical agreements between Taiwan and the mainland. And for all the fire and brimstone and breastfeeding and apocalyptic statements and very substantial military exercises by Beijing, they've reduced the number of flights between Taiwan and the mainland. And they put restrictions on some trade, ancillary trade, not high-tech trade. They've done different things that are largely symbolic. But despite the great Nancy Pelosi crisis of the 21st century, Beijing has left these very important agreements in place. It's important to keep that in mind, given you can bet on it. It's going to happen, the next Taiwan Strait crisis that will become a media obsession.
Mm. Can we just take a moment to have you tell our listeners about the woman who leads Taiwan? She sounds interesting.
Yes, the first woman to lead the Taiwan government, President Wei is a really interesting figure. She also became president when she was relatively young. The KMT, short for Kuomintang, the traditional nationalist China party that Chiang Kai-shek led for many years and led to Taiwan after the communist victory and taking over the mainland in 49, they dominated the island for many years. Chiang's son, very much to his credit, when he took over the family dictatorship, he's the one in 86 who opened the doors to democracy and representative government. The DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, is the main alternative party to the KMT. Ironically, the KMT has, given the history of the Civil War and the communist takeover, they've been able to deal much more effectively with Beijing for all kinds of fairly complicated and interesting reasons. DPP is formally committed to independence. It's very much the party of younger people in Taiwan. It's the party of native Taiwanese. The KMT is much more part of the enormous population that fled to Taiwan in 49. And Beijing has consistently said that if Taiwan declares independence, there will be war. So the DPP, the current government is the second one by that party. Again, they've been able to work things out with Beijing. They haven't abandoned their formal declaration to independence, but they haven't done anything about it. And Beijing and Taipei have reached an agreement over time, over the years, one nation, two systems, which is a kind of symbolic fig leaf for letting things continue without war.
Fascinating. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear today for his monthly visit to the morning show, and I want to be sure we have time to talk about what you wrote about writer Salman Rushdie.
Yeah, but let me underscore as well, President Tsai is very important in Taiwan. I'm very glad that you brought up her role.
Yeah, fascinating person that I knew very little about until I read your columns. I appreciate that. You wrote recently about the vicious attack on Salman Rushdie. As I'm sure all of our listeners are aware, he was attacked in the midst of giving a public speech. Someone charged the stage, and he was very seriously
injured.
Right. Very seriously injured. He will survive, but scarred in a number of different ways. And of course, there's a long history of in a sense, Mr. Rushdie having a target on his back ever since, I think you say, 1998, when the Ayatollah Khomeini called for his murder, I think, in the wake of the publishing of his novel, The Satanic Verses. Tell us what you think is central importance in terms of the story of Salman Rushdie and why we need to really keep this in mind.
The Ayatollah Khomeini, which the senior Islamic religious figure who was in fact formally in charge in Iran, although actually nobody is really in charge in Iran, a fatwa, meaning kill this guy, a fatwa was issued in, I believe, 1988, a long time ago. And it, again, made the news. Rushdie went into hiding for a while, quite cravenly, in my opinion. Walden Books and two other bookstore chains, all now defunct, accommodated that declaration by removing his books from the shelves. Just truly despicable. He himself showed a great deal of courage over the years, and the fatwa faded with time. It's very interesting and significant to me, concerning how times have changed and in some ways improved, that the government of Iran was quick to say that they in no way were connected with this attack. They were not to blame. Mm. Salman Rushdie was to blame. You know, they just can't help it. But they really distanced themselves in a way that they would not have.
Wow.
For many years after the Islamic regime took over. The revolutionaries took over in 79.
Right. Yeah. So if this attack had occurred back in the early 90s, they would have issued a declaration of praise for
whatever. In my opinion, yes.
Right.
So, quite right.
So times have changed, to say the least. That's very interesting. You draw an intriguing parallel between Mr. Rushdie and someone who was a close acquaintance of Winston Churchill. And this is somebody I knew nothing about, Frederick Lindemann.
Yes.
So tell us about the parallel between these two men who at a glance would seem to have very little in common with each other.
You mean Rushdie and Lindemann?
Right.
Yeah. Churchill spent decades in the political wilderness, partly because of his own bad decisions and erratic personality. He started out as a conservative, and then he became a liberal, the predecessor to the Labor Party, and then went back to the conservatives, a man who showed great military courage. I mean, he had tremendous personal courage and personal strength, but he developed a reputation for being unreliable. He was involved in initiating at least one major military disaster in the Dardanelles during the First World War. He was pretty much isolated in British politics until he wasn't. He came back with great foresight, I believe, and effectiveness, warned about the menace of Hitler and Nazi Germany. He came back as Sea Lord. Our Secretary of the Navy would be the parallel at the beginning of World War II in Europe. And then when France fell in 1940, he became Prime Minister. He was very good at collecting ideas and also people during his years in the wilderness. He had a sizable ego, of course, but he was very much aware of the limitations of any human's judgment and the importance of free debate and open expression, something that we inherit very directly from our British friends and is enshrined, thank God, in our First Amendment. We're the only nation that has something like the First Amendment. Hmm. During his years in the wilderness, Churchill really gravitated toward Lindemann, who was a brilliant and recognized as such philosopher and physics professor at Oxford University, particularly effective at quantitative skills. But he was a thoroughly obnoxious individual. He'd come from a wealthy background. His parents were Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. But he was thoroughly obnoxious. If two women were wearing the same dress at a cocktail party, Lindemann would point it out. Or if a man had a soup stain on his tie, there he'd be. He just couldn't control himself. He never married, although once he became a senior government official, he was finally able to get a date and had some social life during World War II, but he was a very sad figure in personal
terms. You call him
at
one point a social outcast.
Yes, well, that's Celia Sands, Churchill's refined daughter-in-law, said he really was quite obnoxious, and she urged Churchill not to have him around. Yeah. I guess she was Churchill, one of Churchill's daughters. Mm. Anyway, Churchill's wife, Clementine, really did not want to have him in the house, but Winston...
And you say that she liked everybody. I mean, like, she had the capacity to see the good in just about everybody, but even Clementine Churchill couldn't quite bring herself to welcome Mr. Lindemann.
Yeah, all by way of freely, but that's right. And Churchill, among his strengths, he was very dedicated to his family, very faithful, and really appreciated how important she was in helping him keep his sanity and keep going during his years in the wilderness. He had other vices. He was a heavy drinker, as people know. He had a gambling problem, which people generally don't know. But his family was his main. But even his vital wife did not want this guy around. As soon as he became First Sea Lord, Churchill brought Lindemann into the government. And his role was to criticize everything that was put forward. Mm. He had an office right next to Winston's. And then when Churchill became prime minister, Lindemann's role, I'm sure he got a lot of larger office, whatever staff he wanted, his role expanded. And he could do pretty much what he wanted to do. But he had the principal mission of criticizing whatever the military brass, starting with the conservative Navy, but then across the board, whatever the generals and admirals came up with, whatever the civil servants and politicians came up with, whatever the members of the senior
cabinet, including especially the prime minister, was to be his number one target. Mm. He was to attack them and try to destroy their ideas. And
so like a full-time devil's advocate in a
yeah.
sense.
Yeah. And Winston told him, in effect, Frederick, I know you're going to enjoy this job thoroughly, but I also expect you to excel. Lindemann wasn't always right, which knowledgeable Brits today like to bring up, but he remains obnoxious posthumously. He wasn't always right. He was very critical of radar, for instance, and he and Churchill would come up with screwball ideas that did not pan out. His role wasn't to be right. His role was to be nasty. In as intellectual and detailed a way as he could, and there he excelled. Hmm. The higher you go in the corporate life, in government life, in any occupation, including higher education, the higher you're able to go, the more there's the temptation to surround yourself with people who will kiss your behind and tell you what you want to do. And Churchill, like FDR, was able to inoculate himself against this.
And Frederick Lindemann was one of the ways.
Was crucial. Yes, indeed. Yeah, no, thank you for bringing him up. And he, you know, professionally he was rewarded. He became Lord Churchill. Money was never a problem for this man, but acceptance was. He became, thanks to Churchill, he became Lord Cherwell after the war.
Right. You write at one point, Churchill possessed a sizable ego, but also enough longhand experience to be well aware of his own fallibility, and because of that, he wanted somebody who was going to speak up in these kind of ways. So you see connection between Lindemann and Salman Rushdie.
Yeah, the importance of freedom of speech. Meanwhile, and tolerating ideas you don't like, quite beyond the fact that personal violent attacks are totally out of bounds and illegal. It's really important to surround yourself, especially when you have authority, with people who are going to disagree with you. In a more human sense, Churchill in the wilderness, the conservative government under Neville Chamberlain tried to destroy him. They tried to get his constituency party to remove him as a candidate. It's important to keep that in mind. When Churchill became prime minister, he went out of his way to include Chamberlain in his cabinet. Mm-hmm. Chamberlain effectively destroyed as a human being by Hitler's double cross, the fact that the Munich Agreement didn't stand at all. He died early in the war. But Churchill kept him in the cabinet, always recognized him and praised him publicly, and always made a point of including Chamberlain's widow in government offense throughout his tenure. When France fell, the Wehrmacht could have driven the British and the French completely into the sea, and other what was left of Allied forces. They could have driven them into the sea. They could have destroyed the expeditionary force completely. Hitler stopped and extended a peace feeler to Britain. There was a lot of support for this in the government, including ministers who had been willing to, who wanted to declare, who felt they had to declare war against Nazi Germany when Poland was invaded. Churchill had a tough time persuading his colleagues, enough of them, to keep fighting. We're too weak. It'll be another double cross. If we have some sort of peace with Germany now, we'll pay a horrible price in the long term. Chamberlain played a crucial role. By that time, Chamberlain was absolutely in agreement with Churchill. It was a very close-run thing, like other turning points in that terrible, very important war. Churchill's insight as a leader in terms of keeping different points of view with him and embracing the man who tried to destroy him politically was really confirmed by that pivotal decision. Just enough members of the cabinet were willing to keep fighting that Winston won that one, as he kept winning, but just barely, until finally, by 43-44, the Allies were finally actually winning.
Yeah, fascinating story.
It is fascinating, and it really shows the importance of the human side in history and the human dimension in leadership. I must say data and analytics is overdone, in my view. At a young age, I had the great good fortune of being in the United States Army when the numbers were all that mattered, thanks to Defense Secretary McNamara and the field commander in Vietnam and later Chief of Staff Westmoreland. They were seduced by this. The data is important, but you got to look beyond the data and put it in context.
I want to give you just a couple minutes to recount a story that you tell in this column that relates to your involvement with the Chicago Council on, I can't remember the law.
Oh, the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations.
On Foreign Relations.
Now Global Affairs.
Right.
Council on Global Affairs.
And you tell a story about somebody who was, I think, maybe brought in to speak or do a presentation, and it was an unpopular choice, and the organization was under some pressure to maybe cancel that appearance altogether. I mean, it was really cool the way you kind of brought in a very personal story to kind of illustrate what you were talking about. So tell our listeners about that.
Well, thank you for bringing it up. It was not heroism at all. It was a comedy of errors in which I was a principal culprit, but a woman who was very loyal to the organization and did a lot over a period of many years. She was on the staff when I came to work there. She quite innocently lined up Shafiq al-Hut, the UN representative of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, at a time when that organization was formally identified by our State Department as a terrorist group. We didn't have relations with them at all. They had an observer at the United Nations. It was a very cunning and cynical effort by a professor at Northwestern University who was fanatically committed to the Palestinian cause. I found out about it when John D. Gray, the chairman of Hart, Schaffner & Marx, called me up on a Friday night. I did talk to her about it, but I didn't focus the way I should have on who this particular Palestinian was. So there was nothing courageous about me. Jack was understandably incensed because, in the clothing business especially, he was a phenomenal CEO. He was not Jewish, but he dealt with a number of suppliers, and including financial support for this very successful corporation. His phone was ringing off the hook with complaints. I told Jack I really thought that he and I were dealing directly because the president of the organization was overseas at the time. I told him I'd find out more, and I did, and called him back on a Saturday and told him the details, and I recommended that we go ahead with the meeting long before the internet, but we did have postal mail and the telephone and the telegraph. My desk was covered with telegrams from, I didn't know there were so many rabbis in North America, but I was hearing from them all. At a board meeting, our President John Riley, a very talented leader who hired me and who ran the organization for 30 years, just extraordinary, we had some rather tense conversations, and at the board meeting, John was very skillful in lining up people like Jack. I learned a lot about big business as a result of the fact that we had a CEO, or nearly that, every 3 years as chairperson of rotating office. Management was in charge then. A lot of corporate people on the board, thanks to John, and it was quite dramatic at our next board meeting. These corporate types, especially younger executives, were clearly avoiding me. And the question was asked at the board meeting, and Mr. Gray, I always thought of Harry Truman when I was around him. Jack was very much like that, very direct, sometimes profane, very honest, a tremendous leader. Jack very calmly explained that we can't let outside groups veto our program. And suddenly we turned into a meeting of the ACLU. Especially younger pinstripes, stood up and started talking about freedom of speech and the American way. But if Jack had gone the other way, it was a very silent meeting. I would have lost my job. Wow. My wife and I had only been in Chicago for a couple of years. We had two young children, very young. I didn't have the kind of contacts I developed later. I could have been out of a job very quickly.
Wow.
So naturally, that impressed me very much.
With good reason.
And confirmed my mind, my analogy with President Truman.
Yeah. I like that.
Another very great leader, I might say.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it stuck with me, that experience.
Absolutely. That's a great story. It's a nice...
Well, thank you. I'm glad it is. It's not just a personal... But it shows the basic strength of Americans.
Absolutely. And that's a great way...
Even corporate types.
Yep. It's a, yes, absolutely. A nice note on which to end. Dr. Art Sear, I so appreciate you joining us today on The Morning Show once again.